Hey y'all, how's it going?
Oh, that's too loud a little bit there.
How's things? I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show.
I think that is a little hot, ain't it? How about that? Is that better? All right, good.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, where I complain about stuff and interview people. And I guess if you had a good weekend and you hadn't caught the news yet today, well, you might have just heard on the top of the hour news, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has rechanged its name again now. It was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then it was the Islamic State of Iraq, then it was the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Levant, or Al-Sham, whatever. Now it's just the Islamic State. They're claiming all of Anbar and up to Mosul and the eastern part of Syria all the way to Turkey. ISIS announces new state in Iraq, Syria, names leader Caliph. Declares its new state restoration of the caliphate, reflecting its virtually uncontested control over a broad swath of land in Iraq and Syria. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has announced the formation of a new nation, dubbed simply the Islamic State. According to the announcement, the Islamic State has been determined by Shura councils to be the restoration of the caliphate, and ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has been declared the caliph. While the Islamic State has been a de facto state for quite some time, albeit one. Oh, this is what you just heard on the top of the news, was Daryl reading Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Well, good. Albeit one with ill-defined borders engaged in multiple wars, the declaration of themselves as the new caliphate is likely to fuel controversy around the world and a direct challenge to Islamist factions. That's because a caliphate claims to be the direct successor of the Prophet Muhammad, and its caliph would at least claim to be the consensus final religious authority for all of Sunni Islam. That's funny. I didn't realize that. Political authority, or all the way around? I guess it's all the way around. Anyway, so there you go. They've demanded that all Muslims in the world bow down. It's a whole new day. And I guess it still remains to be seen. This is reversible if there's a giant war. Things could change. But it sure looks like now you can't really say Iraq anymore. Maybe Syria is still Syria, the rump state is Syria, but Kurdistan's already Kurdistan. I guess you could say Iraq and it just means Southern Arab Shiite Stan, George Bush land. No, the Islamic State should be called George Bush land. Let Shiistan be Dick Cheney world, or Ariel Sharonistan. How about that? Ariel Sharon's great idea. That's what we'll call it. Yeah, man. Wow. There you go. The Islamic State. Mark the day. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing. I mean, it's just what I always said was going to happen and everything, but now it's happened. In fact, I was thinking, you know, I wonder what exactly I wrote about this in my, I wrote two whole articles last year. I really need to be disciplined about that, man, and write more. I wrote two whole articles last year, and one of them was called Stupidity or the Plan, both for the Future Freedom Foundation. And, boy, did I get this all exactly right a year ago. So they're already, I mean, it's not like I made it up, I just was paying close attention. They already are talking about, well, maybe we'll just, if we can't take Damascus, maybe we'll just unify with Western Iraq and create a new caliphate there. They didn't, well, I don't know if they used the term then, but I said, look, it's the creation of the Islamo-fascist caliphate that George Bush was lying his ass off about all this time. In fact, well, you regular fans of the show know that For weeks leading up to this invasion, I guess I wasn't predicting, they're about to head west or east into Iraq and take Mosul or anything that specific. But for the few weeks leading up to this, well, for a few months, but especially the last few weeks leading up to this, I was interviewing Giraldi and Scheuer and Landay and Prothro and as many of these guys I could possibly get on. Did I say Patrick Coburn, Patrick Coburn, Patrick Coburn, Patrick Coburn? He wrote his 5-part series on the rise of Al-Qaeda's new generation just in April. So, and in fact, I'd been talking about it with him leading up to that. I kind of remember taking a little bit of credit to myself anyway, only now for the first time out loud that I wonder if I influenced him into, you know, going ahead and breaking this down into a big 5-part series the way he did. Because that would have been cool. But anyway, I was telling Jonathan Landay, you might remember, see Landay, and he's going to be on the show in a little while, he has got such a chip on his shoulder over George Bush lying us into war, and that's because, you know, frankly, I think, not that he ever said it this way, but I think, you know, it's understandable that if people just listened to him and read his journalism in Knight Ridder newspapers, there wouldn't have been a war. He debunked every last war lie before the war ever happened. So I said, geez, look at this, Jonathan Landay. Eastern Syria, Western Iraq, completely lawless, dominated by, if not the tribes, by these ISIS characters. It's like the Islamo-fascist caliphate come to life in real life. George Bush is lying. And he, like, interrupted me and wouldn't even let me get to my punchline. That, like, George Bush was lying his ass off trying to pretend that the secular fascist in olive green with a clean-shaven chin, Saddam Hussein, was some kind of Islamo-fascist. You're looking for an Islamo-fascist. I guess you could have pointed at Hosni Mubarak or the King Abdullah. Saddam was a fascist, but he was more of just an atheist who believed in himself only. But anyway, Landay was like, he couldn't even let me get to my joke. He was just like, George Bush is a liar. But then, yeah, now look. And actually, what Bush was trying to claim was, you know, like all of Islam, which Bush himself, no, but his people, they were all claiming, like, basically, all you need to know is the Muslim. Remember that guy working for Mitt Romney had to get fired from the campaign? He's like, we got to stop the rise of the Muslim. Like, there's one really big, really mean Muslim over there. He's coming to step on us and give us Sharia. Whatever. And anyway, yes, of course, that was an absolute lie. But the punchline being, Bush overthrew Saddam Hussein with the clean-shaven chin and the olive-green uniform, and replaced him with Zarqawi. And then now with this guy, Abu, what the hell, Baghdadi calls himself, although they say he's from Samarra. I don't know. It's amazing it took this long. In fact, I have to admit that on a couple of things. I admit that I'm still, in a way, a little bit surprised at how long they kept the peace. After the Sunnis lost Baghdad and called time out, turned on the Al-Qaeda guys, and then, you know, the Americans left and all that, the status quo held, really, from 2008. I mean, because the Americans pulled back to their bases mostly by 2009. Mostly. 2010. Anyway, the status quo was, of course, butchery, murder all the time, but on a low scale, you know, relatively speaking, compared to like 2007 or something. Talking bombings here and there and murders and crime, and, you know, America destroyed the entire society, so what do you expect? But for the status quo, as bad as it was, to hold as long as it did, yeah, I guess I admit I'm surprised about that. And I guess I gotta admit that I'm surprised that the Americans have stayed out this long. Although I think that's about to change. Jonathan Landay and Dan McAdams coming up on the show today, y'all. Stay tuned. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Jonathan Landay, who tried to truth you out of war back in 2001, 2002, and 2003, is going to be on the show here in a little while to talk about Iraq and the rise of the Islamic State. Now, listen, I want to talk about this very important piece, I think, in the Daily Beast today. It's by J.M. Berger, and I've interviewed him one time, and it was about the Oklahoma bombing and his research into the radical right, Timothy McVeigh's friends that helped him do it. Of course, the cover-up was because they were all undercover FBI informants or flip states witnesses of one kind or the other, so the Justice Department completely let them get away with murder. And anyway, so I interviewed him about that one time. He's one of these, you know, terrorism experts, which may mean that he's smart enough to have been against the Iraq War. I don't know, back then. But I follow him on Twitter, and he seems to pay very close attention, and I can't say I've ever seen him really recommending bad policies that I know of. But, well, he's a terrorism expert, not a libertarian, not a peacenik, not a kind of guy who is, you know, adverse to using American power in principle to kill terrorists. He would be all for that if he was all for it in whatever circumstance. I think that's why it's really important to listen to his explanation of why not to do that this time in the case of the new so-called Islamic State. ISIS risks everything to declare a caliphate. After months of gaining territory, weapons, and cash, ISIS is putting its global credibility on the line in a play that could backfire spectacularly. On Sunday morning, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, or ISIL, if you must, pronounced the reformation of the caliphate, a historical Islamic state that once stretched over much of the modern-day Muslim world, with ISIS emir Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as the man in charge. It is arguably the boldest move yet by the group, which renamed itself simply the Islamic State. But if ISIS isn't careful, this could be the moment when all of its gains in Iraq and Syria are squandered, when would-be allies are alienated, and when the group's critics within the jihadi community were proven right all along. In the statement, released in Arabic, English, German, French, and Russian, ISIS claimed that it had fulfilled all the legal requirements for the caliphate and that all existing jihadi groups and indeed all Muslims around the world were religiously obligated to swear loyalty to the new caliph Ibrahim, using the name provided by ISIS in the course of proving that Baghdadi has the required lineage for the title. Prior to this pronouncement, my assessment, again this is J.M. Berger writing in the Daily Beast, was that there was almost no way ISIS could exit June in worse shape than it entered the month, and that still holds. But July is beginning to look like an open question. ISIS, an al-Qaeda breakaway group, had made a bold move to seize territory in Iraq that had resulted in tremendous gains in both equipment and money. Even if it lost all the territory it gained in June, it would still retain many of these spoils, with new clout, status, and physical assets to compete with other jihadi groups operating in Syria and near the Iraq border. The declaration of the caliphate is a massive gamble that puts many of these gains at risk, although the potential benefits are also substantial. Here's a quick rundown of the moving parts. Again, this is J.M. Berger writing in the Daily Beast. ISIS risks everything to declare a caliphate. As I've discussed previously, ISIS has been competing with the original al-Qaeda for leadership of the global jihadist movement. A great history of the conflict can be found here by Aaron Zellin from the Washington Institute Near East Policy. ISIS's recent gains in Iraq projected strength and dynamism, while AQ Classic looked weak and indecisive. Al-Qaeda has maintained a slim but diminishing lead over ISIS among key influencers in the movement, and more recent data suggested that it was hurting Al-Qaeda in fundraising networks, although it appeared to be diminishing enthusiasm for the jihad in Syria overall as well. The pronouncement of the caliphate is sure to be wildly controversial on religious grounds, but ultimately it could cut either way. The backlash may harden the pro-Al-Qaeda segment of the global jihadist movement against ISIS, especially with the announcement's flat-out demand that all other jihadist groups are religiously obligated to pledge loyalty to ISIS.
but it will also generate some enthusiasm from foot soldiers in different segments of the global jihadist movement that see ISIS as a rising star. There is a risk of high-level defections from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, particularly in North Africa, where several groups and segments of groups have already broadly telegraphed their sympathies towards ISIS. A significant number of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula supporters in Yemen have also been showing signs of sympathies for ISIS for some time. Since the announcement, social networks in the neighborhood of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula appear to be supportive. On the other hand, Muslims worldwide are likely on the whole to react negatively to the pronouncement. The question here is how many currently nonviolent radicals will jump toward ISIS and how many will jump away from it. Again, this is a high-risk, high-reward scenario for ISIS. It could reap considerable benefits, but the backlash could be severe. Regardless of how it plays out, today's pronouncement will likely generate new streams of fundraising and fighter recruitment, even as it depresses others. The long-term outcome is unclear, but much may depend on what happens next. Damn, dude, I gotta skip ahead. I'm out of time. Wait, yeah, where's the... I'm skipping something important. I don't even know what. Sorry. There is one factor that could cause all of this to work out dramatically in ISIS's favor, but it would require a large number of variables to fall into place. That factor is U.S. intervention. The prospect of a U.S. military intervention, most likely in the form of airstrikes, was already problematic. While there are many who understandably favor hitting ISIS in order to deny it control of territory in Iraq, such a strike would bestow on ISIS the one thing it has until now been unable to definitively claim: legitimacy. A potential new line of jihadist argument then emerges. The caliphate was restored, but it was directly destroyed by the United States. Iran could also possibly fill the villain role here, resulting in a different possible tectonic shift in the global movement, and I suppose the Israelis could also intervene, which would probably overturn the entire playing board and start a new, very unappealing game. Even before today's pronouncement, there was a substantial risk that U.S. strikes on ISIS would bolster its standing in the global jihadist community, allowing it to gain ground against Al-Qaeda in the battle for hearts and minds. U.S. strikes could also subvert the trend in recent years toward the localization of jihadist conflicts or unite the currently splintered jihadist movement against the U.S. as its primary enemy once more, with ISIS subsequently holding a central position in a unified global struggle. If the pronouncement of the caliphate is received as legitimate by some significant number of jihadists and their stay-at-home supporters worldwide, and if the United States is seen to be the most important contributor to destroying that nascent caliphate, there could be cascading consequences on a scale we have not previously seen. It could result in waves of terrorist attacks in the West, a surge in foreign fighter recruitment and fundraising, and significant instability in Middle Eastern states that aren't already experiencing it. Those are two extremely large ifs. But if this has been ISIS's plan all along, it is audacious but borders on the insane. It is an all-or-nothing gambit. ISIS has meaningfully put its existence on the line with today's pronouncement. It's playing the lottery, and while the odds are stacked against it, sometimes people win the lottery. Above all else, it is clear that ISIS is an adrenaline addict. If the group survives, it may be emboldened to take even greater risks, and our strategy needs to be informed by that understanding. There you go. So that, again, is ISIS Risks Everything to Declare a Caliphate by J.M. Berger from IntelWire today at the Daily Beast. And you can tell he's no peacenik. He's just being smart. America, stay out. Stay out. Oh, too late. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back. All right, well, good. Jonathan Landay said, wait, don't call me at 12:30. Call me at 1. And that's good because, well, what the hell? There's so much Iraq stuff to go over here that we can't possibly cover it all with Landay. He likes to talk, too. But I want to mostly focus on what's going on the ground over there and that kind of thing. And, you know, the international politics, too. But anyway. Listen, here's the part of the essay that I skipped. Again, it's J.M. Berger, and I tried to get him on the show today, but it didn't work.
But it's Jan Berger from Intel Wire here in the Daily Beast. ISIS risks everything to declare a caliphate. So here's the part I missed, and it's all really good. You should read this thing or, you know, I don't know. Listen. ISIS made its gains in Iraq as part of a coalition of Sunnis with grievances against the Maliki government. Those groups may have seen a temporary advantage in aligning with ISIS, but the pronouncement of the caliphate sends a clear message to all of ISIS's Iraqi partners that they are the subordinate parties in this alliance. ISIS may have cleared this move with its key allies in advance, but if it didn't, a power grab could splinter the very coalition that allowed it to seize territory in the first place. More significantly, the calculus... I hate that, the calculus. I wish people in Washington, D.C. would stop saying calculus and optics all the time. I just hate that jargon. Just speak English, okay? How it looks. You don't have to say optics. Just say how it looks. And calculus, I guess that one has been in use longer. But it's still so phony. It's just a bogus way of making 2 plus 2 equals 5 type ridiculous government arithmetic sound complicated and smart. Oh, geez, I guess you intelligence officials have your calculus, and so you know who to kill. We're just supposed to defer to them because they're ridiculous and stupid, pretend fancy jargon. Wow. Calculus. I'm so impressed. You guys can do calculus, huh? Honestly, my brain froze up pretty much at about 10th grade geometry. I don't know. Well, really, Laura was terrible, but Bill, I understood it when Bill taught it. Anyway. Yeah, the calculus. I guess ISIS has to do their calculus now. All right, where was that anyway? Is that in here? Yeah, here it is. More significantly, the simple arithmetic of holding territory has now changed. Prior to the pronouncement, ISIS could have fallen back to its previous domain along the border of Iraq and Syria with little loss of face, and a huge increase in its warfighting capabilities thanks to the captured American weaponry and millions of dollars of stolen funds. Now, if ISIS is driven back, Baghdadi risks being seen as the man who grasped for the caliphate, held it in his hands for one brief shining moment, and then lost it all. Such a loss would highlight the hubris of ISIS in making this pronouncement, and would also seem to validate the arguments of Al-Qaeda emir Ayman al-Zawahiri, that ISIS's methodology was flawed, and that the splinter group was putting the cart of the Islamic State ahead of the horse of fighting jihad. The question now is how confident ISIS is about its ability to hold substantial territory in Iraq. Reports suggest it is under heavy pressure in Tikrit already, and the United States has yet to deploy any air power against the insurgents. If ISIS made sure its partners on the ground would support the pronouncement, and if it withheld the pronouncement till it was sure it had consolidated its gains, then it is in the position to reap the benefits. If ISIS rushed its timeline or overruled objections from local partners, it may lose its territorial gains quickly and end up condemned for an arrogant and ill-advised power grab. The wording of its pronouncement certainly reeks of arrogance, demanding an oath of loyalty from essentially all Muslims, with dissenters being labeled sinners at best, apostates at worst. At best, and in the absence of any surprising new information, which could certainly be coming, ISIS appears to be standing on the edge of a precipice with an adolescent faith in its ability to keep its balance. It may be able to walk that line, but it's a stunning and unnecessary risk by a group that could have navigated the next few months with excellent odds of an outcome that ranged from good to very good. Now it has introduced a much higher risk of an outcome that is truly bad for its long-term prospects. Well, don't give them straight advice, dude. You know they read the Daily Beast over there because of Eli Lake. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. Wow, so there you go. And now, what was Zawahiri's argument with all the jihadis all through the 90s and whatever? Why should they join up and do it Osama's way? To fight the far enemy, us. Because what was the argument? We're never going to be able to overthrow our local dictators. We're never going to be able to make our Islamo-fascist caliphate. As long as the American Empire is backing up every dictator in the region. Now, of course, that doesn't mean they would be able to do whatever they want if only America wasn't backing their enemies in reality, only just in their frame of reference, what they believed. And so they said, we've got to drag in the Americans, bankrupt them by bogging them down in our quicksand, and then force the American empire out of the region altogether. You know, a replay of America's replay of Vietnam in Afghanistan for the Russians in the 1980s. Going to war in Afghanistan when it was a trap set for the Americans for the Russians, it was meant to bog them down and bleed them to bankruptcy. That was exactly the whole point of it. Ask Zbigniew Brzezinski, he'll tell you. And then America goes and does this to our own selves. After having the direct comparison to Vietnam in our hands in 1979. But anyway, so then Iraq and going, you know, that much, you know, on the other side of Persia from Afghanistan, you know, what 2,000 miles to the west now or whatever it is, the Americans just did. It was the hoped for but unexpected gift to bin Laden, as Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, put it, to invade and regime change Iraq and to turn especially the entire predominantly Sunni parts of the country over into just lawless jihadistan. These guys to train and practice all that time and to grow and to learn. And anyway, so if America intervenes now and bombs the crap out of these guys, nobody doubts the ability of the Americans to destroy the crap out of things from the air. Now, if they just all go, you know, guerrilla on us and everybody hides in a civilian home, then that's going to make it very difficult, which will probably be their strategy. You know, could be expected to be their strategy. Obviously, some targets are out in the open, but not the leadership, not what counts. But anyway, if America, say America, Iran, and Syria, and Russia, and Iraq all ally together, like Voltron, to fight against ISIS, which is already happening, and they really can smash the hell of these guys and chase them back to the border, chase them back to Syria, something like that, as Berger puts it in here, that will be the most powerful thing to turn the ISIS's war against the United States. The propaganda will be simple. We had it in our hands and the Americans took it from us. And so of all the grievances that they had before 9/11 that led to 9/11 and all the ones America's created since then to turn these people into our enemies, the civilians of the United States of America, it is time to back off now. People are criticized. I saw somebody criticize. I was Noah Schachman. When these conservatives in their conventional wisdom, like they all just get an email every morning telling them what to think. It doesn't matter if it makes any sense or not. Boo-hoo, the Russians are intervening in Iraq to prop up the government America and Iran put in power in Baghdad. Because they're exploiting Obama's power vacuum that he left there. Cry me a river. Stay the hell out, America, at this point. Turn them drones around. Bring them advisors home now. Before it's too late. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Yeah. So, it's a whole new day over there in the Middle East, man. I don't know if, you know, I don't know. Maybe Iraq will exist again at some point. Maybe Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Russia and America can all combine together and conquer Mosul and Fallujah and all the western and northwestern provinces, cities and provinces there again? What do you think?
I don't know. It's funny when you put it like that, ain't it? You know what? I never do get to enough of the news on this show because I think I ended up just, I never got to it and had to just go ahead and exit out and move on. But I had one from last week about John Kerry telling Iran and Syria and Russia to please stop helping because you're making things more complicated somehow. You can't admit you fought a war for your enemies. You voted for a war for your enemies, John Kerry. You piece of crap, who was such a piece of crap, he lost an election to George W. Bush. The worst loser, after he had already accomplished being the worst loser to be president since, I don't know, Nixon. You ought to have to go back further than that, right? But nah, I don't know. I guess Roosevelt or Truman, those would fit. But yeah, that's how it's shaping up. America's on both sides. America's on the side of the rebels in Syria, the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria, against it in Iraq and pretty much everywhere else. They were for it in Libya for a while before they were against it. Again, paraphrasing John Kerry, the pathetic, ridiculous, idiot Secretary of State of the United States of America. All right, well, there you go, Mitchell Prothero McClatchy. ISIS declares establishment of caliphate, demands allegiance from all Muslims. Let me just run down the list here. Democrats split on strikes in Iraq. Hey, if Obama wants to do it, he's our dear leader, says most of Congress. Others say, oh, come on. You know what? Did I mention yesterday? Oh, I did. I talked about this yesterday. Never mind. Matthew Dowd, that used to work for George Bush, who said his son was in the Iraq war over there, two tours, and just was hardcore against it and going back. That reminds me. A friend sent me an email this morning asking me some questions that I ought to cover here. What's the bigger story here in the mainstream news? Megyn Kelly does her dumbed-down version of Greg Palast on Dick Cheney. TV News has a smart, nice, anti-war person, Katrina Vandenhuevel, finally give ultimate douchebag neocon Bill Kristol a nice slap upside the head for all to see. Right, did you catch that? Katrina Vandenhuevel from The Nation told Bill Kristol, yeah, if you're such a tough guy, why don't you go join the Iraqi army? Army, you architect, you can see what happened here with my language, you architect of catastrophe. I was thinking of saying that next, and then boy did I cross my dang neural pathways up. Bill Kristol, the architect of catastrophe, says we need to go back in there, huh? You go join the Iraqi army if you want to go fight, tough guy. And that was good. But really, the line was, the better line belonged to the better line belonged to Dowd. Oh, I didn't say this. It was just happened yesterday, right? Who did I tell this to? Not you guys. Dowd used to work for Bush. Came out hardcore. And his statement, hers was the cute, you know, practiced soundbite, which was good because Kristol deserves to be smacked down. But it was Dowd who I thought, and really brings the point of this question even more to the for to me. All of a sudden TV, even though they're bringing on all the war hawks and everybody's complaining about that, and rightfully so, that they're letting all these war hawks pretend to be experts up there, I think the backlash has already come, right? Like Kelly Vallejo said in the American Conservative magazine, that finally the consensus is, nope, you guys are jerks and idiots and you're always wrong and we all know that this is all your fault. And there's just, I'm sorry, everybody's, you know, that's the consensus around every kitchen table in America. You did this, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Bremer, Kristol, etc. This is on you. And so, no, if you want to go to war, then we're not going to. In fact, I was saying we ought to celebrate Dick Cheney is leading the charge on this. It just helps discredit the interventionist position even more. Everyone knows that he was
more responsible for this than anyone. And so I think, yeah, part of it is so he says here's his multiple choice question. Is mainstream TV trying to execute an intellectual turn here upon realization that they're losing viewers and readers at alarming pace because viewers and readers realize that guys like Crystal are indeed stooging U.S. foreign policy? Yeah, well, I don't know exactly what you mean. He's always talking in World Wrestling Federation terms. And so if Crystal and them are deliberately destroying America, I don't know if that's what you mean. I wouldn't say that, but they sure don't give a damn what happens. I don't know, man. Yeah, I guess they put Israel first, and they're just as happy. Bill Crystal's just as happy to see America burn every last bit of life and property in this country for that one. Right? Seems like it. Is right-left anti-war crowd finally starting to connect on these issues? No. It's the public consensus is against it. The left and the right anti-war factions don't exist and don't do nothing. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to sell short the actual efforts. You know, comehomeamerica.us and that kind of thing. And there are people doing good work. But as far as is there some kind of crowd, really, that even can work together? You know, I don't know. I think what it is it's just everybody. I think the whole society is basically just over it. Enough of the wars over there. What are we going to do? We're just going to wage wars over there forever? Are we allowed to stop ever? What is this, right? It's not even a necessarily very informed thing. Just, well, it seems like a lot of people are dying, and what do we got out of it? And can we stop now? It's freaking halfway through 2014 now, right? All the hot air I've blown this whole time hadn't made a damn bit of difference. It's just the calendar. And so regular people are saying, I've had enough. Okay, come on. And so then, yeah, back to the viewers and the readers. Yeah, they've blown it. Because just, you know, you don't have to be a foreign policy wonk or a political scientist to know that the media has not performed their job of checking the government and making sure that what they say to us is true. And so we just don't believe in them anymore. You don't have to be you or me, you know, some kind of hell-bent critic of the system and the way it works to know this stuff. Again, back to the consensus around every kitchen table in America anymore is these guys just aren't believable when they tell me what's necessary. I just don't know. If they say, oh my God, it's necessary, I say, really? You know, I don't know. Show me another burning building on these shores and I'll think about it. You know, that's what they answer. But this or that faction is fighting each other over yonder? Eh. Isn't it time for Bush supporters to finally admit his presidency was a disaster and a big reason that set up our current disaster? Yes, yes. Again, looks like that discussion is now on the table. Exactly. Now, will the American people take responsibility for the individual Americans who cheered for this? Who argued with their friends and their co-workers and their family members and hoorahed for George Bush? No, they won't. You know as well as I do, 95% of them, they don't even revisit that question at all. And if they did revisit, they lie to themselves right before they lied to you. Oh, that wasn't me. Yeah, some people were like that. But, you know, and that's really unfortunate, I think, and it goes along with the complete and total lack of accountability in the media, in the government, and also in the larger population. And maybe that goes first. Maybe people are so dishonest and are so, you know, bent on saying, oh, nothing to see here, moving on, that then they allow for that same kind of thing on the part of all the major TV networks, cable news, the New York Times and the Washington Post. Lie me into another one. That's what happens. When you don't get accountability, that means the people who weren't held accountable are the same ones doing the same thing to you again. Right? I mean, our next guest, Jonathan Landay, and don't tell him I said this, but I just mean it. You know, whatever. There may be others I'm not thinking of, but why isn't he the editor of the Washington Post or the New York Times after his triumph and everyone else's failure in 2002 and 3? Huh? No accountability. And was Cheney threatening us? Nah, he's just trying to scare us. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers. He tried to truth you out of war for Knight Ridder Newspapers back in 2001, 2, and 3, but you didn't listen. You didn't read. And so now, next step is, one, two, skip a few. ISIS declares establishment of caliphate, demands allegiance from all Muslims. That's the headline from Mitchell Prothero, Landay's colleague there at McClatchyDC.com. Welcome to the show, Jonathan. How are you doing?
It's nice to be back. I'm well, thank you.
Bad news.
Well, kind of inevitable. That's what they said they were going to do, and they've done it. The only question is how long this can last and if it's viable, and there's big questions about that.
Yeah, you know, did you see this thing by J.M. Berger in the Daily Beast today? ISIS risks everything by declaring the caliphate.
Boy, I have not, but I've had some of my own sort of thoughts.
Let's hear them.
Well, the first thing is, you know, they're still fighting for what they to hold on to what they've captured, and we don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. Certainly, it looks like they've still got the upper hand. You know, there was the first major Iraqi counteroffensive over the weekend, or actually beginning late last week, to try and recapture Tikrit, which was the hometown of the late Saddam Hussein. And it looks like, at least from all the accounts I've seen, including our own, that the Iraqis have not made a lot of progress. But beyond that, the fact is that it may well be that ISIS has kind of set itself up against all sorts of all the other Islamist groups that are claiming that, you know, that they're the guys who should be running the caliphate, and that includes Al Qaeda and their core leadership, which is still based in the tribal the regions of Afghanistan, of Pakistan, and let's not forget that ISIS has been fighting in Syria with Al Qaeda's official branch there, Jabhat al-Nusra. Now the question is whether or not Jabhat al-Nusra is going to actually be able to remain cohesive, given the success that ISIS has had in Iraq and in Syria. So there's that factor. How will their declaration affect that? But also, making this declaration, the head of ISIS, a guy by the name of Baghdadi, kind of declared himself the defender of the faithful. That would be Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the defender of the faithful. Well, that's a title that Mullah Omar, the leader of the Afghan Taliban, claimed in 1996. So who is it? Is it Baghdadi or is it Mullah Omar? So you see where I'm going with that. There's a big question as to whether or not the jihadi groups will themselves have a falling out over this. And then there are the groups that ISIS has allied with in their drive from northern Iraq towards Baghdad. And these are a bunch of different groups, but including nationalists, Iraqi nationalists, who include former members of the Ba'ath Party, of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, and his former military. And now they're not jihadis. They're not, you know, they don't have the same philosophy, share the same philosophy of that ISIS shares, that ISIS has, and right now it seems more like that they're aligned with ISIS in terms of as an alliance of convenience, because they're both aiming at toppling the Shiite Muslim dominated government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in Baghdad. But once they've gotten that, if they ever get that, then, you know, they have to have a ideological reckoning, as well as a physical reckoning. Is it Baghdadi who's going to run the show? Or is it going to be some of, you know, the top former leaders, top leaders of Saddam Hussein's regime? So there's all these questions out there. But the fact is that the declaration will add prestige and appeal to ISIS following its military triumphs over the last 3 weeks in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, well, let's cut straight to the point here. And this is the conclusion that Berger makes after citing a lot of the very same things that you talk about here, is that one way to kind of insulate ISIS from all of these different opposing pressures that you're talking about would be for America to bomb them. And for whatever, especially if then they end up losing some of these towns and having to retreat, and then they get to point the finger at America for destroying their awesome caliphate that, of course, we created for them in the damn first place. But anyway, that's how to turn these guys into waves of anti-Western suicide bombers, and that's exactly what not to do here, even though, of course, everybody in D.C.'s finger is itching on the trigger, want to just blast the hell out of these guys.
Well,
because
I'm not
what
sure
are you going
to
do? Let them create an Islamic State?
Well, Scott, I'm not sure that everybody in D.C. is itching to do that. I don't think the American military itself is very enthusiastic about doing that kind of thing because, you know, to be effective, airstrikes have got to have American boots on the ground, special forces, or at least drones overhead, lasing targets and finding targets. Now, these guys are operating now. Yes, there are large stretches of open roadway and desert that these guys have to drive through, but they're also in the cities. And there's no doubt that they've infiltrated Baghdad, that they've got people we know now who have staged operations south of Baghdad. So they're not just to the north of this capital or in the south.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, I'm pretty sure there are people in the American military who are none too enthusiastic about using airstrikes, not because they're concerned that ISIS will start launching suicide attacks against American targets. They've already said that they plan to do that, as have other groups. So I just think that it's, you know, once you open that door, you're on the slippery slope to even greater involvement in what essentially is this catastrophic mess. Politically, it's difficult, too, because, look, it puts the United States, at least on the Iraqi side of the border, on the same side as Iran and the Shiite militia in Iraq, who were killing Americans not too long ago. So I'm not so sure that there are a lot of people. There are people, certainly people like John McCain and others, who have been, you know, rooting for airstrikes, but I don't know that there are many people within the administration, including the president himself, who are very gung-ho about that option.
Well, you know, I think I agree with that, but I guess I can't shake the idea that they're going to do it anyway. It's the unavoidable logic of the empire. They've got ships full of Marines and full of air power, just, you know, not far from there at all, right there in the Persian Gulf, ready to go. They've got, you know, maybe a threat to Jordan's sovereignty now,
right,
on their eastern border, and they've got fleets of armed drones over Iraq already. They've at least announced. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I just don't see how they cannot bomb them. We're talking about the USA here.
I haven't seen any announcement that they actually have armed drones. Certainly that they've got drones that are doing what they call ISR missions, you know, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and sharing some of that information, at least with the Iraqis, at least information that's not overly sensitive that they don't have to worry about it being passed on to the Iranians, who, don't forget, are also advising the Iraqis. But I think a lot of the deployments that you talked about are more about bolstering American allies who are concerned about what they think they see as being an American retreat from the region. You mentioned one, and that's Jordan, but there's also Saudi Arabia, which shares a border with Iraq, and some of the other Gulf Arab kingdoms. And so I think, for the, you know, it seems to me that at least up till this point, President Obama is doing the least he has to do.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that holds. Now, hold on just one second. We'll be right back, everybody, with Jonathan Landay right after this. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show on Liberty Radio Network and scotthorton.org. I'm talking with Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers. And like I was saying, I didn't really say this in his introduction, but I was explaining in the previous segment. This is the guy who got it right about the neocons trying to lie us into war starting in the fall of 2001 for Knight Ridder Newspapers. And not just Landay, but his associates there at Knight Ridder Newspapers back then. And so, you know what, before we get back to the current thing, I gotta ask you this, because it's controversial and it's going around again, as it should be, I guess, and I'm kind of a mixed opinions about it, and I gotta know what you think of this, and I'll be overly simplistic, and then you can be as complicated as you want, Jonathan. And that is that, say, for example, Tom Engelhart had an article recently about the horrible failure of the neocons and the Bush administration in getting what they wanted in Iraq. Oh, they thought it was going to be easy, and the Iraqi people hardly existed. They were just figments of our imagination. They would do whatever they were told, and we would have a nice little democracy, and that would put all this pressure on Iran, and they would have either Chalabi or a Hashemite king build a pipeline to Haifa for water and oil, and the whole thing is just going to be great forever. It's going to be, we're going to expand our footprint in the Middle East and blah, blah, blah. And then the whole thing just blew up. Sistani called for elections or whatever you want to say happened, and the whole thing just completely fell apart. On the other hand, and there is kind of paperwork going back, as I know you're well aware, of neocons talking like what they would really like to do is smash all the Arab states into warring tribes of warring tribes who could never, ever possibly be a threat to Israel ever. And Iraq was the largest, could-be, rich, powerful Arab state, only one Jordan away from Israel, and that maybe the neocons' real objective here was chaos. That's why they abolished the Ba'ath Party. That's why they abolished the army. That's why they invaded Iraq in the first place was really, as a writer puts it recently here, the Michael Ledeen's boiling cauldron doctrine. Let's just turn the whole region into a giant mess and whatever, see what happens after that, or expedite the chaotic collapse so that we can then determine what should happen after what. And I don't know if you think either both of these are right, or a little bit of both, the first one, then the other, or something. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think it was delusional to begin with, that idea. Yeah, and I've read Michael Ledeen's writings and others, and their idea was not only not to stop at Iraq, but, you know, to unseat all sorts of Arab regimes, Muslim regimes, because, you know, who posed a threat to just not to Israel, but to the United States and the West. And I think my recollection is that included Iran, which, you know, it's not quite about, you know, just the Sunnis. They were viewing, you know, all of the threats against, so-called threats against the United States, which was totally delusional, given that it would have required, you know, the United States to deploy its entire military in the Middle East, which is nuts. I don't know that all the neocons were on board that particular program, quite frankly. I'm sure that they weren't, I'm sure, or else we would have seen them attempting to do that. I'm sure that that Cheney and Rumsfeld saw Iraq as an opportunity to demonstrate to the world that the United States was not going to take 9/11 sitting down, and Afghanistan was simply inconvenient or a 2 week of a target to make as an example to the quote unquote axis of evil countries, and of those three, Iraq appeared to be the easiest to invade and push over, and we've heard Wolfowitz actually say that once many years ago. I don't know why we were listening to them then. I don't know why people are listening to them now. You know, I was I did an interview with Huffington Post last week in which I used the following analogy. I said, you know, you go to a doctor with an ailment, and the doctor says, okay, this is what you've got, and I'm prescribing these pills and this surgery, and it turns out he got his diagnosis wrong, and the prescriptions that he made that cripple you for life. When you get sick again, are you going to go back to that same doctor? No, you're not. You probably sued that doctor for malpractice. And unfortunately, we cannot sue Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Fife, Rice, and the rest of them for malpractice, but we can stop listening to them.
Yeah. All right. And now, by the way, a footnote here. And you got your own sources, so I ain't contradicting you. But just so you know, New York Times reported June 26, support for Maliki slips within his own party as armed U.S. drones start flights.
Okay. And that's, thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Eric Schmidt in the New York Times there. So, but yeah, now, and so back to that question of Obama trying to do the minimum. Believe me, it's occurred to me that we could have John McCain as president right now. And, well, he'd have got us all nuked in a war with Russia long ago, so it would be a moot point. But
my
anyway,
quick response to that is, how come Maliki is still the prime minister?
I'm sorry, how come he is?
Maliki is still the prime minister.
Right. Well,
and
so what about that?
Him flipped inside his party.
Yeah, well, and they got the parliament is coming back together again. When? In 2 or 3 days?
Yeah. I think Ayatollah Sistani wanted this thing done by tomorrow, and it hasn't happened. So you got to ask yourself, well, how come if support turned against Maliki inside his party? I haven't seen any results of that. Now it could be also that Iran has a lot to say about that situation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's this piece in. I don't know how to say it. AAWSAT.net, and they're saying it's between Abdul Mahdi, Hakim's guy from Skiri, and Chalabi. And
that could very well be. We've been hearing about Chalabi for a couple weeks now.
Yeah, that just seems so crazy. I can't wait to hear all the liberals justify it when Obama goes along with that. That's why I hope it's him, just to see it. Salon.com saying, well,
but then you're going to see the neocons come out and say, see, we got it in the end.
Yeah.
He was the right guy.
Can you imagine? All right, well, and now, so wait a minute. If it's Sistani or Sauder, who was, after all, at least at first, wanted a government of national salvation, as they called it back in 05, and before with the Sunnis, sent his fighters up to Fallujah back in 04 and was more of an Iraqi nationalist against Iran and the United States at the same time early on. But could anyone at this point reach those benchmarks of 2007 that the Sunnis are going to have so much representation in Baghdad that they don't feel so bad about losing it anymore? I mean, come on.
I'm unfortunately not the great expert at internal Iraqi politics, and it's quite possible that you're going to see there are still Sunnis, I think, Sunni leaders who have not abandoned the idea of, you know, trying to put together some national salvation kind of government. But the question now is, can the Iraqi army hold it together long enough to be able to push ISIS back, end the threat against Baghdad, and, by the way, the Shiite shrines, which I think are probably the real target for ISIS now, not Baghdad, in order to be able to create conditions in which such a national reconciliation government can run the place.
Is there any chance you can do one more segment here, or you got to go?
I can do one more segment.
Great, great. Thanks. And it won't be as long as the last one, I think. Hang on just a minute. We'll be right back with Jonathan Landy, y'all. Hey, y'all. Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code SCOTT when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And the big news is that yesterday, ISIS declared a caliphate.
from, I guess, Raqqa in Syria, formerly known as Syria, all the way to the suburbs of Baghdad. On the line, we've got Jonathan Lande from McClatchyDC.com, McClatchy Newspapers. And you were saying there about, you know, the question is, can the Iraqi army hold it together? It seems like the answer is, if so, only with the help of the Badr and Sadr militias, which means it will, you know, to defeat ISIS, they will end up, needing to employ sectarian militias that will then be that much more counterproductive toward ever achieving any kind of compromise with the Sunnis and reforming what was called the state of Iraq the day before yesterday.
Indeed. And that's why I said earlier, I think that ISIS's next targets are, it's not going to be Baghdad per se, but look, they're looking, I think, to throw more gasoline on the Sunni Shia fire. And to do that, they would look to try to drag Iran into this mess, which would then drag the Sunni Arab states into this mess, most likely. And to do that, they would do that by going at one of three or more holy Shiite cities. They've tried to go at Samarra, which they seem to have failed to do. But then there's also Najaf and Karbala. And by and we know that they've already declared their intention to destroy the Shiite shrines in those cities. And we also know that Iran has made the destruction of those shrines red lines. And so if they really want to stir things up even more than they already have, that's what I think they may try to do.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it seems smart from their point of view, if not to bait America in, which is a concern of mine. People are saying, well, they're no threat to us. I think they might be if they're trying to, reenact the bin Laden scam and lure us in to defeat in their sand and bankruptcy and all of that, like worked so well before and again. But the same thing is they could do that to Iran, and that's what I would expect them to do, is to try to do everything they can to bait Iranians into intervening, just to rally, right, not just legions of fighting age males from around, but the states of the Gulf region too, into, you know, perhaps getting into a real full-scale, major-scale proxy war there.
But they've already declared their intention to target Americans. They've warned America. They warned Americans last week. There was a day, I forget, was Friday, Thursday or Friday, where they did this incredibly intense campaign over social media, Twitter, warning the United States, warning the Obama administration not to stage airstrikes, because that would mean that they would come after Americans. But also, they've issued threats of that nature before. And let's not forget that there are thousands of foreigners who are in ISIS's ranks, Europeans and Americans, who could turn around and come back home and become threats. That is something that the U.S. intelligence community and European intelligence and government are very worried about as well.
Yeah, well, and of course, it's already happened, right? One of these ISIS veterans, a Frenchman, murdered two Jews at a museum in Brussels last
month.
Exactly,
exactly.
So it's already on.
Exactly.
Can you imagine the French army in there? I guess, why not?
I don't think you're going to see. I think one of the things we're seeing, Scott, is a reticence by the United States and Europe to get involved in what's going on. Especially look at the United States. Once upon a time, when oil was a major, major factor for the United States, I think we would have seen a lot more of American involvement earlier and much more intensely, not just in Iraq, but in Syria. But, you know, the United States is approaching a point where it is going to be self-sufficient in petroleum. And that changes the strategic calculus of intervention a great deal. I also think that President Obama, looking at, I was thinking about this myself, since World War II, I don't think there's been any major successful U.S. military intervention anywhere except Kosovo, Grenada, and Panama. And I think the president looks at that, and his people look at that, and they say, you know what? Every time the United States has intervened in a significant way militarily, especially in the Middle East, we have screwed that situation up worse than it already was. And I think he's trying to change that kind of knee-jerk U.S. foreign policy where, you know, we have to get involved in a crisis, particularly in the Middle East. And you've seen a lot of pushback. You've seen a lot of criticism of the president, particularly from, you know, the McCains and Lindsey Grahams of the world, about, you know, how the United States is relinquishing its leadership in foreign affairs, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's to be expected if indeed the administration and the president is in fact trying to change what has been American foreign policy for decades.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, it's one unbroken chain of intervention since Woodrow Wilson.
And, that's right.
Every crisis they create becomes the excuse for the next one, and on all the way down into Nigeria now. So I don't know. If he's finally figured out there's such a thing as blowback and actually wants to make policy based around that fact as kind of a central theory of foreign relations, then great.
Well, he
it's
puts
only
it
2014.
Another way. I mean,
it's about time
to...
somebody in D.C. learned about this.
Well, you have,
but you're right. I mean, what we need is a clean break. We just have to say we can't fix Nigeria. We can't fix Mali. We can't fix Libya. We can't fix Syria or Iraq or anything. What we can do is quit trying to.
Yeah, but I mean, he doesn't quite put it in those terms. Read the speech from West Point, the recent speech, and the way he puts it is, you know, he's only going to get involved militarily in crises where Americans or American interests are directly threatened. Now, you know, the world isn't as clean as that, right? The world is not as clean as that.
That's what George H.W. Bush said, too, and look at us now.
Well, no, I think I'm not sure that that's where he was coming from, but the world isn't neatly packaged that way, and what's going on in Iraq and Syria interfere with that approach, in that, as we just talked about, there are genuine potential threats that these crises are creating against the United States, and in particular against the stability of U.S. allies and friends in that region. So, you know, it's not quite as neatly packaged as I think he would like it to be.
Yeah. Hey, how crazy is this? What if ISIS just all of a sudden, like an arrow, rush west to Jordan? Is Israel and the United States going to have to put boots on the ground there to keep Jordan's borders?
I think they would have a very hard time doing that, because the only place where there are, I think, are substantial, at least strong, U.S.-backed Syrian rebels are in the south, are, you know, along the Jordanian border and the Israeli borders. I mean, I think that's, if there's, you know,
yeah, they're working with us.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, that the CIA, I've been told, you know, I was in Jordan last year and I was there, as told, you know, this CIA-led operation, it's very modest, and it's been arming and training and arming some vetted Syrian rebels to ensure the security of those two borders, but not much more than that. So I think it would be a hard row to hoe for ISIS to be able to do that. But nevertheless, and the other thing is the virtually the entire Jordanian army is deployed on their border with Syria, and I suspect they've been making deployments to the Iraqi border as well. So we have to wait and see. But certainly, you know, this is stuff that has gotten this administration to change what has been policy for 3 years,
yeah, we'll
with the announcement last week of the $500 million in train and arm assistance that they want Congress to approve for the quote-unquote vetted, moderate Syrian opposition, which I'm not sure really exists to any great degree anymore.
Yeah. You're saying that the guys that they're training in Jordan, their only role was basically just staying on the border?
That I was told by Free Syrian Army people in Jordan was that there were you know, that was the object. Someone, one of them, one of my
contacts. Giving them tow missiles and all that, though, right?
Yeah, but not a lot. I mean, you haven't seen, and it's not just there. It's in the north as well. But you haven't really seen them making a great deal of difference, have you?
No.
And I think that you know, that those videos we saw and the supply of those missiles were part of what we now have seen is this announcement by the administration to train and arm vetted Syrian rebels. I think that those videos were taken by those rebels who were given the tows they videoed their use of the tows as proof that they were using them and not selling them, which has been the fear, to other rebel groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then they then put them up on, and they showed these videos to the Americans. But
well, I actually read a thing at the Long War Journal that said that al-Nusra was already getting them, though.
I thought that they were getting that they had obtained the Croatian anti-tank, or sort of the former Yugoslav anti-tank missiles, and not these tows.
Well, I don't know the detail, but I read on the Long War Journal. In fact, let me ask you this. Hell, we're already into the commercial break. Anyway, what about the Islamic Front? What the hell is the Islamic Front? When the FSA got seemingly pretty much chased into Turkey back in, late December, early January, then all of a sudden there was this Islamic Front, and they became the new moderates. But who is that really?
We have to wait and see. For the most part, I think the Islamic Front consists of mainly one group, Ahrar al-Sham, and maybe some other Islamist groups, but they're sort of like the third major Islamist group, Syrian Islamist group, fighting the Assad regime.
Yeah, I guess
we have to wait
that was
see
what
it
said
the
Long War
well.
Journal, was those guys were fighting with Nusra in a battle,
yes,
and they
yes,
had
yes, the they've absolutely, absolutely. They've been aligned with Nusra and the FSA in fighting ISIS.
And that was what Prothero said on the show the other day, was that those are the guys who are receiving the weapons and the money directly from the Saudis, are Ahrar al-Sham.
Or were. We're not sure that that's Saudi policy anymore.
All right. Well, it sure wouldn't make sense. Well, I guess it would make sense for them, but it wouldn't make sense for America to let them get away with it. Not at this point, right?
Right. Well, we'll have to, well, you know, again, there's a great deal of uncertainty about all of this.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've kept you way, way over time. Thanks very much for your time, Jonathan. Talk
absolutely to anytime.
Appreciate it. That's Jonathan Landay, everybody, from McClatchyDC.com. Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
Me. What exciting theme music.
You know, I read a thing where Mel Brooks was saying, yeah, you know, when the new Star Wars comes out, maybe I'll do a new Spaceballs. Hey, Mel, you do that. Yeah. Consider that official encouragement from me. I'm fairly certain that's exactly what you should do.
A little whistle between my teeth there.
Hey, Phil Giraldi is coming up on the show. Now, he hadn't written anything lately, I don't think, in the last week or two. But I'm sure he's got some complaining to do about the hell's going on in Iraq right now. Hope so. If not, well, then I'll just ask him about Israel. I bet he'll have something to say about that. All right, Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest coming up on the show. And also, Dan McAdams, I bit my tongue, and it didn't hurt that bad, but it messed up my talking. Daniel McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity will be on the show to talk about Ukraine. And boy, I better read some things during the break, because I'm behind on that subject, and I need to know. How am I going to ask him any questions when I've been kind of distracted? All right, well, anyway, so, you know, man, I should have thought of this in the last break. Oh, well, too late. Eric Garris is a genius at counting votes in parliaments, counting factions and their divisions and who can be maneuvered into doing what. You know what I mean? He is a public choice theory on voting in practice. He will make you choose your enemy. He's just good. From his days in the Libertarian Party and various left groups and that kind of thing, he's been an electoral politics kind of a guy for a long time. And he explained this to me so well, I should have had him on the show today to talk about this. Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki, oh, that's the director of antiwar.com, if you don't know. Iraqi PM Maliki facing rival Shiite bids for premiership. And this is what I was mentioning to Lande there, this thing that says it's between Chalabi and Al-Mahdi. Are you kidding me? Al-Mahdi is from the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. The Iraqi traitors who fled to Iran, fought on Iran's side, and even tortured Iraqis during the Iran-Iraq War, who then came into Iraq on George W. Bush's boot heels in 2003, and who all along has fought for exactly what we've got now. Strong federalism. You know, the reason there was a united society was there was a united state. It was a fake state. Anyway, even when it fell apart, it didn't have to fall apart like this, with America exploding it to death and getting a million people killed. And stop letting them play that down either. Lancet was saying 655,000 by 2006. And Opinion Business Research said, yeah, that tracks exactly with our math right up to where we got a million. And Opinion Business Research went back. That was in the fall of 07. And I was trying to get the guy on the show and he wouldn't do the show. Why? Because he decided, man, that number a million is just so damn high. I got to go back and do this again. So we went back and did it again. Paid by nobody to do it other than that was his specialty there. Opinionbusinessresearch.co.uk. And he sent his people out to do the household surveys and this, that, and whatever. And there's every reason to believe that number is accurate. At least that it's in the very high hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed because of the way America set about dismantling their dictatorship with daisy cutters. And with death squads. Oh, which death squads? This guy's death squad. Abdul Mahdi, he's the guy from the Supreme Islamic Council. The Bada Brigade, the Wolf Brigade torturers like in the WikiLeaks, Maliki's Special Forces, that's who these guys are. The Iraqi Army, that is the Bada Brigade. And, you know, Dawah Party didn't have their own army. And so Maliki had to compromise, or I guess the Sadrists and the Supreme Islamic Council had to compromise on Maliki because they each had their own army, so they didn't want the other guy to be the president and have the army. So they picked a guy with no army to be the compromise president between the two of them. And anyway, the point being that, so now they're going to get rid of Maliki. They're going to try to get rid of Maliki, the Dawah Party guy. Or now his own party is called the State of Law Coalition, but he only he requires the votes of, he has in the past required the votes of the Sadrists and the Supreme Islamic Council guys to have his prime ministership. I call him president, but you know what I mean. And anyway, so there you go, man. Back when Sadr was saying, "Let's hold Iraq together. We're all Iraqis. Let's band together to kick out the Americans and the Iranians. We don't want a Shiite South. We want Iraq." And Iraq wants us, and let's get along. And he demonstrated. He fought on the side of the Falujans twice against the Americans. And, in fact, you know, worked to limit and constantly denounced Abdulaziz al-Hakim from Skiri for always pushing for federalism and trying to break the state apart. And his sectarianism. And yes, when it came to full-scale civil war, the Sadrists were among the most ruthless torturers and murderers and sectarian cleansers of the Sunnis out of Baghdad. That is an absolute fact. But that was until 2006, 2007, 2008. when the war was 3 years old. And anyway, and then Chalabi, he's the guy that the Ayatollah sent to lie you into war, you stupids. If America is going along with Chalabi right now as the new prime minister, holy crap. I don't know what. I mean, I guess nothing surprised me at this point. Oh, it's just amazing. And yeah, you know what? If you want to know about that, it's not just that. Well, I heard one time that maybe Chalabi had leaked some secrets to the Iranians. No, it's that the CIA and the DIA did a damage assessment report. I think it was a damage assessment, whatever it was a report that determined that Ahmed Chalabi was an Iranian spy who the reason he was backed by Iran, which they already knew, was because Iran wanted him telling the Americans the things he was telling them. Regime change in Iraq will be good for Israel. It'll be easy. The Shiites of Iraq, they're Democrats. They're not religious kooks like in Iran. They're just like you and me, Paul Wolfowitz. Anyway, yeah, they were in Iran. They were the Supreme Islamic Council, ready to cross the border and seize power. And those are the guys that Bush and his administration chose to do business with. You know, because I think, as Bob Dreyfus explained on the show, was part of it was that Hakim had nice clothes and manners and stuff. And Sauter is a working class guy. And so from the Republicans' point of view, like, look, if any of these guys, if we can do business with any of these guys, it's got to be the hoity-toity higher culture type. So that's all Hakim. And it didn't matter that he worked for the Ayatollah in Iran, you stupids. And anyway, you know, the other thing is Sistani in 2004, in January 2004, Sistani, the supreme, the highest ranking of all Shiite religious leaders, higher than the Ayatollah Khomeini in Shiite religious rank, said, hey, if you believe in God, go outside and tell the Americans one man, one vote or else. And I don't know how to say one man, one vote or else in Arabic, but that's exactly what the hell they went outside and said. And George W. Bush went, oh, man, what am I going to do now, generals? And they said, I guess you're going to give them one man, one vote, boss. What's wrong with this thing? That was funny. I just lost one channel on one of my recorders, but not on the other. Oh, that's mysterious. Anyway, yeah, what a disaster. So, yeah, again, non-intervention. And by the way, I absolutely second and third what Landay said about the threat of all the ISIS guys coming back from Western Europe. And that's another one of these freaking headlines today. I got so many headlines here. Crucifying fighters and Tikrit. And these guys are coming west to bait the United States. Here it is in McClatchy. With ISIS surging in Iraq, Europe fears rise in jihadi tourists. Me too. They're going to try to get America to reinvade. Don't take the bait like you did last time, you big dumb bull. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hour three now. And Amic Adams is coming up to talk about Ukraine here at the bottom of the hour. But first, it's Phil Giraldi, formerly a CIA and DIA officer. He's now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. And he writes at the American Conservative Magazine. That's theamericanconservative.com, at uns.com, and at america.aljazeera.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. So what do you think about what's going on in Iraq?
To be honest, I'm mystified by all this. I mean, there's no coherency to what the U.S. government is doing. You know, it was a week or so ago when Obama was interviewed by CBS News, I believe it was, and said that it had been a fantasy from the beginning to think that these insurgents that we were supporting in Syria could possibly overthrow the regime. And now we're giving $500 million to train these very same people in Jordan, apparently, with a CIA program. So, you know, this is the whole strategy of what's going on in Syria and Iraq is totally incomprehensible to me. I don't see where there's any kind of quick fix to this situation. I'm beginning to question whether the United States has any good intelligence information on what is going on there. I don't know if you saw the interview with Mike Morrell, former director of operations for the agency, who admitted that CIA case officers in Iraq don't go out of the embassy very much. So the question becomes, to what extent do we actually have a handle on what is going on in either of these countries?
Yeah. Well, you know, on the Syria thing, this is where the interview just left off with Jonathan Landay. Are they trying? They really are trying to, and how much? How many mercs can you buy with $500 million? Are they trying to create an army that really can fight against, you know, al-Sham and Nusra and ISIS and all the other jihadi groups and Assad and get a regime change there? And you can get about one millionth of a regime change for $500 million, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't even understand what they're aiming to do. The $500 million. First of all, it's a lot of money. You can train a lot of people on the ground in Jordan for that kind of money. But who are you going to be training? I mean, you're going to be training like as Obama put it, you know, shopkeepers and people like that to become hardened warriors. I mean, that ain't going to work. I mean, and how long is this training going to take? 12 weeks? 16 weeks? You know, going by my own experience in the United States Army, I would say that. To train somebody for combat, you're talking about a lead time of 4 or 5, maybe 6 months. And what exactly is the intention? If they want to go out and hire mercenaries, I don't know what kind of mercenaries are even available that would be considered to be politically reliable. So, you know, the whole thing is just so screwed up. If you had made this up and written it in a piece of fiction, nobody would believe it.
Yeah, no, I know it is. It's completely ridiculous. And the obvious answer is sitting right there. If you want to train anybody to fight ISIS in Syria, it's Bashar al-Assad's army.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean, I'm not saying I'm for that, but I'm saying if you got to train somebody in Syria, it would be the secularist, Baathist coalition of Christians and Shiites. And some Sunnis, actually, too.
Well, that's the whole point. If all this stuff is based on threat to the United States, then who is threatening the United States? Well, ISIS and some of the other radicalized groups that are fighting Assad. So, you know, if that's really what's going on, we should be, if not supporting Assad, at least stepping aside and letting him do the work. And so that doesn't make much sense. And it doesn't make much sense, this other argument that's been coming out, too, about how ISIS is intending to attack Britain, intending to attack the United States, and they're going back to this old argument about home, you know, native-born terrorism coming back to bite us on the butt, as it were. But that argument's not terribly convincing either, because nobody seems to come up with any numbers or any kind of plausible explanations as to how many of these people there are. I mean, if there are 30 of them, is that a threat to the United States? If there are 100 of them, is that a threat to the United States? And are these people really intending to do that anyway? Because it's very clear that their focus is on Muslim regimes in the Middle East. That's their focus. They're not interested in us.
Hmm. Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just paranoid, but I disagree with you about that. I think you look at the, there was an American that went and did a suicide attack in Syria, which at least he did it there, but a kid from Florida last month. And then there was the attack by the ISIS guy in Brussels who killed two Jews at a museum with a shotgun. And it seemed to me like, you know, the strategic logic of suicide terrorism. By all means, lure in the French, lure in the Americans, and bog them down, recreate the war of 03 through 08. Why not? Rally more people to their cause, bog us down and bankrupt us. That's the whole game. The action's in the reaction. Get us to overreact and blow ourselves up.
Well, that is, you know, that's certainly a plausible theory, but I just don't see that where the numbers and the actual narrative is there.
I sure hope you're right about that. Because I don't want the Republicans and the Democrats to have to say, listen, we've got no choice but to intervene after this. And by the way, it only takes one guy to go and do something pretty bad, as we've seen all over the place. If any elementary school shooter was actually some guy with an Islamic Jihad red headband on or whatever, then that would be a war, right?
Yeah, well, sure, it would be a war. But the problem is if we buy into the argument that these groups overseas are all out to get us, then we're giving the Democrats and Republicans plenty of ammunition. I just don't think, all right, a guy, you know, a nutcase can kill people, can blow himself up, he can get a weapon, he can shoot kids, he can do anything. But does this threaten the United States? Is this a threat where we should be going to war with countries in the Middle East or getting involved in wars in the Middle East? And I'm saying no. I'm saying that they have not demonstrated.
I think we can only make it worse by intervening. There's no doubt about that. Bush gives them Western Iraq, an entire Wild West to practice and become the Islamic State in the first place. Obama then backs them, at least by default, and we can get into that maybe in the next segment in a little more detail. But for years now, as you first reported, you're the one who broke the story. Obama signed a finding he's going to back the rebels in Syria, and that doesn't necessarily mean all the rebels, but in effect it does, and with all the guns and the money. So anyway, you know, I don't see that there's a possible good thing that a single U.S. government employee could do about this. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't worry that they would try to follow that same strategy of provoking America. I think they're going to do the same thing to the Iranians, too. They're going to blow up as many Iranian targets as they can to try to turn this into as much of a civil war, a Sunni-Shia civil war, as they can over there, you know? So, I don't know.
Yeah, but see, Scott, they're only able to do that because we're involved in the conflict, see? And the only motivation they would have to do that is because we're involved in the conflict. So that's the whole point. I mean, if they go after France or they go after the French, it's because the French are big players in terms of what's going on in the Middle East right now. And if they go after the United States, it's because we're involved. The whole point being that if we're not looking at this in terms of it being a threat to our existence, and therefore getting engaged militarily and diplomatically, then we're not a target for anybody. Nobody's interested in us.
Right. The problem is Obama wants to do this thing where he dips in a toe. I'm not saying I'm arguing for any intervention ever, of course, but I'm just saying that the halfway treatment here where, yeah, we got American drones and American advisors and just enough American influence here to make whatever happens to them partially our fault, but not enough to protect us from the blowback created then. It's the same thing as before 9/11. Bin Laden always said that we were already at war with them, but it was just that we had hired Mubarak and Assad to murder them for us.
Lure
us in and bog us down, and the whole damn mess that they did. Anyway, what a disaster. Phil Giraldi is on the show. We're talking about the new Islamic State of the former Syria and Iraq. We'll be right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi, as I often am on this show. He's a former CIA counterterrorism official and writes for the American Conservative magazine. And has been talking since about this terror war ever since I've been listening to him, which was about 9, 10 years ago, something like that. And, you know, one thing I was thinking there, Phil, during the break, which might be worth saying out loud, is that I think after Zarqawi died, was bombed by the army back in 2006, that was when his successors renamed the group from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They started calling it the Islamic State of Iraq. And I'm pretty sure it was right around that time that the local Sunni tribal councils and religious leaders and former Baathists said, yeah, right, screw you guys. You're the tiniest, you know, fringe part of our insurgency, and you're not the boss. We're the boss. And that was really the beginning of the awakening, was before Petraeus ever even got back. Which he didn't, you know, this whole called, whole so-called surge and all that crap didn't really start until January 07. And it was really in 06 that these guys already had completely worn out their welcome in Iraq because of, well, first of all, they basically got the Sunni, the civil war good and lost for the Sunnis, the way they picked a fight with all of the Shiite society, basically, and rallied support for those who were cleansing them from Baghdad. And then also just conscripting people and bossing them around and declaring themselves the government of the place when many of them were foreigners, including the leadership, weren't even Iraqis. Anyway, so what I'm trying to get at, to make a short story long, is aren't they just going to cease to exist here pretty soon anyway with all this we rule the world crap, when really they're nothing but a militia of however many few thousand guys, right?
Yeah, that's again one of the great mysteries about all this. That obviously they were able to seize the moment, and they were able to step into essentially what was a power vacuum that has been kind of created over the past few years, and certainly the government, the regime in Baghdad has been contributing to this. And but essentially, yeah, they don't have any real long-term viability as a nation state, which is what they're aspiring to, and that eventually will fall apart. In fact, it might fall apart very, very quickly, I would rather suggest. So the whole thing is, if you follow the U.S. media coverage and everything on all this, it's kind of crazy. It doesn't take into account any of these external factors that impact on the narrative they're trying to create. And to go back to what we were talking about in the first half, I mean, I would not give these clowns in Washington any rope at all in terms of, you know, claiming that this what is happening over there is a major threat against the United States, because that is the argument they're going to use essentially to justify an intervention. And I think you and I know, and probably everybody listening to the show knows, that an intervention is probably the worst possible thing that could happen.
Yeah, I mean, politically, the people certainly are against it, and so it does seem like, you know, Obama's not up there beating his chest about it too bad. He's sort of playing down the threat of ISIS, at least in some circumstances he's been playing them down. And he's saying, you know, minimal effort, send some drones and some advisors, and of course that could be a terrible slippery slope, but... you know, all the political pressure from the people of the country is against this kind of thing, but all the political pressure against him in Washington, D.C., of course, is from the hawks, who are always the loudest, attacking him from the right. So,
yeah, that's exactly right. And there was an editorial, I guess, in the Washington Post yesterday, again, calling for military action to resolve this. But the underlying argument is that the United States is threatened, because essentially, the politicians know that nobody or no American is going to enter into one of these wars in the foreseeable future unless that case is made. That, look, you're directly threatened, your children are threatened, this is what's going on, and so on and so forth. But it's basically a bogus argument. They've never been able to make the argument that the war on terror was justified in any way by the reality of the terrorist threat. And that's what I'm arguing, and that's, we're seeing this kind of playing out again, where they're trying to create this threat out of nothing, or out of very little, mm-hmm. And they're trying to use it to justify more military action, to justify more U.S. involvement in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time where Al-Qaeda was just a few dozen guys, you know, somehow Rumsfeld had them surrounded on three sides, and they got away. But that was about it. I mean, Bin Laden made a great postcard from, Goldstein, the permanent enemy or whatever. But when they caught him, he was hiding in the attic, even from his own wife. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, now, like, well, I don't know. I mean, at the same time, they really have, they've spread them far and wide. I guess the numbers are still not that big, but there's enough stateless territory for them to rally in North Africa and into Yemen and in Iraq and Syria now, where they certainly make a good enough poster child of an enemy to whip up a war against, I think, if they want one. But yeah, I think you're right. It certainly remains to be seen how long they're going to be able to get anybody to listen to them.
It's like the neocons are basically praying for another terrorist attack. You know, it's self-evident because they keep citing the fact that another 9/11 is coming. Lindsey Graham a few days ago said exactly that this situation in Syria and Iraq was another 9/11 coming. In fact, I think he even said it would be much bigger. I'm not exactly sure what his sources of information are, but it's that kind of scaremongering that they're doing, and that's why I think we have to push back against the scaremongering, because that's the only argument they have. There's no evident U.S. national interest in what's going on in Syria and Iraq, apart from this hypothetical threat that will be coming across the Atlantic Ocean and getting us.
Well,
so we have to push back against that.
Yep. Well, I don't know. I guess I'm still paranoid that if all it takes is a couple of dozen guys to hijack four planes, and you have hundreds of guys who've gone to fight in Syria, maybe that some of them could get into the United States. Certainly could get into the West. And I guess I wouldn't rule out the threat completely, but again, I think that's even more reason why not to intervene rather than a reason to intervene. And I don't want them to say that us peaceniks sound like we're naive and that, we're just singing Give Peace a Chance and they're the only ones who are, know what must be done and all that kind of crap, because they love to play that. It seems like the way to diminish the threat is to stop doing what they want, which is to take their bait and react in a way that empowers them at our expense and threatens us even more. So, but anyway,
yeah, that's right.
That may be too complicated of a point to make on Twitter,
Yeah, no, but that's exactly true. The whole point is, we empower these people, and then we wonder why they're attacking us. And so the whole argument that, well, they're attacking us, therefore we have to attack them harder, it just creates more justification for what they're doing.
Right.
And it's totally crazy.
Yep. All right, well, thanks, man. I'm sorry I asked you to stay another segment with me, but I got to go to Dan McAdams on the Ukraine issue here. But good to talk to you again, Phil.
Yeah, yeah.
Appreciate it.
Okay, well, say hi to Dan.
Yeah, will do. That's Phil Giraldi, everybody. He's at the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com and the Council for the National Interest. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Man, that's weird the way that's cut with the whole first thing cut off there. It starts at the second one. Whatever. Anyway, hey, it's my show. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Dan McAdams. He used to be Ron Paul's foreign policy guy in his congressional office, and now he's Ron Paul's foreign policy guy as director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, and now he's a Texan. Welcome to Texas, and welcome to the show, Dan. How the hell are you? Oh, did I say it? It's Daniel McAdams, everybody. Welcome to the show. Oh, I hit the wrong button. Now welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Scott. It's great to be with you again. It's great to be in the same state as you as well.
Yeah, yeah. Come up to Austin. We'll get some barbecue.
Will do.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
All right. And, I should ask you to help me get Ron on the show sometime soon. It's been a little while since we've spoken, and I've got a couple of things I'd like to ask his opinion about.
Oh, okay, well, we're almost neighbors now, so.
Holler at him out the screen door there. all right, good times. What the hell is going on in Ukraine? Catch us up on the news. No, in fact, put off the news for a minute. Let's talk about the history a little bit, because I know part of the news is the EU trade deal thing, and you can't really tell us that without having to backtrack anyway. So why don't you start with the backtrack and explain about the trade deal and what role that had in the whole regime change operation and how we got to June 2014 in the Ukraine crisis. And then we can catch up on the current violence, the talks, the role of the Russians, and everything else.
Okay, sure. Well, as you know, late last year, when the then President Yanukovych was pondering whether he should sign this deal with the EU, which would have given them associate membership in the EU or an association agreement with the EU. It had exclusivity on it, and it would have, according to his analysis, would have prohibited or at least interfered with trade with Russia, which certainly Eastern Ukraine has a lot of trade with Russia, and it's a very important trading partner next door. Also, the Russians, kind of upped the ante and said, "Hey, look, we'll give you $15 billion if you stick with us and don't sign this exclusive agreement with the EU." So he balked at the last minute, and I think there was a lot of big players on the West side, the U.S. being the biggest, but also the EU, also minor EU players like Poland felt themselves to be very important. And they made numerous trips to Kiev and ginned up this whole protest in the street, which, as we know, became very violent. A last-minute deal was brokered on, I think it was the night of the 21st of February, whereby they would have early elections in exchange for, calming the whole thing down. But somewhere in the middle of the night, the coup took place, probably because the deal was crafted by the EU and Ukraine. It was probably the U.S. and our good friend Victoria Nuland who came in and wanted to put her guy Yats in power. So there was a coup that night overnight. Yanukovych fled the country. An interim president named himself. And there were elections wherein a good part of the country could not vote here a few weeks ago. I think May 20th, elected a new president, Poroshenko, the chocolate king. One of the oligarchs, which is kind of funny because the whole thing, the protesters said this was a protest against corruption in government, corruption in politics, get rid of the oligarchs, and here you have one of the biggest oligarchs who's now in charge of the country. The East did not go along with the regime change in Kiev. They've been historically closer to Russia, and in fact, up until not that awfully long ago, were actually part of Russia. So they were not too keen on what happened in Kiev and in the West. So they decided to try to break away. And Kiev, with U.S. support and EU support, has been particularly brutal in putting down this attempt to dissociate themselves with the regime in Kiev.
All right. And now, on the night of the coup, I wanted to point out this article and... Boy, I guess I could have Googled it or something real quick. I should have. I believe it was in Der Spiegel in Germany that talked about the billionaires and the oligarchs and their role in the coup. And it was quite simply that the Americans and the Europeans had told them, you better forsake this guy or we're just going to steal every last dime that you have outside of the country. And
yeah,
so those were the guys in the Party of Regions, the party of the president. And so that was when they withdrew the last of their support. So at the same time, I mean, I'm just adding what you're saying, emphasizing the point here, that at the same time that they were making a deal for to call for new elections, which, were to take place in December, et cetera, like that, the rest of the compromise, while they were making that deal, they were actually telling his party members, we are going to destroy all of you. We're going to take everything from you if you don't get rid of this guy right now. And that was what caused him to finally, well, that and the Nazis occupying the palace and or whatever mansions and government buildings, giving him basically nowhere to rest his head for the night. He went ahead and took off for the East, right?
Yeah, and also, some of the Party of Regions members who were not oligarchs were simply prevented from voting against the so-called impeachment of Yanukovych. So there was a lot.
Well, they didn't even get their numbers on the impeachment anyway, right? They just claimed it anyway.
No, they didn't. They didn't. But that was okay because the right guy won. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, there's corruption and there's these guys. I'm sure I have no doubt that, you know, they were they were ready to make a deal with whoever. You know, they wanted to keep all of their ill-gotten riches on both sides, on all sides, which is really the tragedy of post-USSR Ukraine. It's a it's a country potentially very wealthy that has been absolutely destroyed by corruption, by oligarchs, by ill-meaning people, and by, frankly, people in the West who see it as a potential area to enrich themselves as well. Look, you know, this whole controversy over the vice president's son ending up on the board of one of the biggest oil companies there. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is how it works. This is the transnational elite carving up countries, you know. And so this is a potentially, as who was it, Brzezinski, who said Ukraine is the prize. And so there you have it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, JP Sotili, the News Vandal, had a great write up all about, well, I'll go ahead and name names, but I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was Archer Daniels Midland and Monsanto and some of the other just household agribusiness firms who have major interests there as well now. And what all role with the oil companies they played in sponsoring some of the same groups and all that kind of thing, all that cronyism. But now, so let me ask you this about the IMF loans, and we're going to get to the recent stuff, but we got a whole other segment too. But when it comes to the IMF thing, the standard economic hitman thing is you get them in so much debt, you just break them, you liquidate all their assets, you give it to the connected cronies, get to keep it and put it in their Swiss bank account and whatever, and then, you know, let the people starve, or who cares what happens to them, you just move on to the next one, you know? Like vampires sucking the blood out of nations. Only, it seems like if they want to really kind of colonize, they meaning the West, America, and the European satellites, they want to really colonize this place and integrate it into NATO and into the EU and all this kind of thing. And their economy is already $1 zillion in debt and completely broken and hardly works at all. Whatever wealth they do produce gets sucked right out of the country by aforementioned oil companies and agribusiness firms, right? And so what's the point of taking on something? I think this is part of, got to be part of what's keeping Putin out. I mean, Odessa is a pearl, but Putin doesn't want it because the whole damn country is a complete wreck and basket case. It's nothing but a pile of liabilities. So help me understand, I mean, assuming that they have any idea what they're doing, what the hell these people think they're doing in trying to take over the country, but at the same time trying to put it under one of these IMF regimes that's just going to take it from broken all the way to hell. And now the damn music.
There's the music.
See, I need to figure out how to ask a question on the radio without going on for a minute and a half, but after 15 years, I haven't figured it out yet. So place your bets on me continuing to ask questions all the way up until the break and then stalling as the music plays and let you know. We'll be right back with Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity right after this. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Oh, all the news I didn't get to today. Well, that's what tomorrow's for. Right now, we're talking with Dan McAdams about the situation in Ukraine, the American coup d'etat there in February and the aftermath. And I was asking some kind of question there about why the hell would they want to, first of all, take on basket case Ukraine, and then at the same time, they're saddling it with IMF internal economic destruction at the same damn time. Dan, can you make sense of that for me?
Well, I think, you know, if you're going to go conspiratorial, it makes sense to demoralize the population with IMF austerity. I think you've already seen the beginning of significant ethnic cleansing of eastern Ukraine. You know, and this is where the industrial sector is built up the most. So I think, yeah. You know, there was a UN report that came out this past week saying that over 100,000 refugees from eastern Ukraine have poured into Russia. It's interesting that the U.S. has not said a single word about it. You know, this is not RT or Putin or anything else. This is the UN saying over 100,000 people have streamed into Russia, getting away from the fighting, getting away from the shelling that the Ukrainian army is doing on civilian populations, and the U.S. is completely silent. So on one hand, if you have the populations terrorized by Kiev, then all of a sudden you see their gas, electricity bills going up 50 to 70% and their pensions cut in half, these people are going to leave. They're going to leave the East with all its riches to be exploited. So maybe it's a conspiracy theory, but if you look at what's happening, it seems to be happening exactly that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wouldn't call that a conspiracy theory. I asked you to speculate, so conspiracy theory is when you abandon the rules of argument and go with your faith instead, to me, which is quite a bit different. Anyway, yeah, so, no, I mean, I think that that's, you know, really, like I was saying, just a plausible hypothesis, basically, to explain, you know, the policy of breaking the place. I mean, you know, they talk about having talks. It makes sense that if they want to hold the place together, they would, you know, I mean, and I know how politicians are, Dan. I'm not trying to be naive here, but
yeah.
In this specific situation, it seems like, you know, when Chocolate King comes to power in Kiev, his first order of business obviously should be not a big show of strength and bomb the hell out of people and scare them all across the border. It should be, hey, we're all Ukrainians, we're all brothers, let's sit at the table and work this out. Yeah, we got away with bloody murder overthrowing your president, but now let's try to work something out. And instead,
yeah.
And there's some talk of that, right? I'll let you elaborate on that, but you know, I'm just trying to agree with you that it seems like the policy is more like let's all scare them the hell across the border, like you're saying. And I don't know if the whole IMF and austerity, it would go along those same lines, but why not? Yeah, go ahead and wreck the place even more.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, what's interesting is, and this goes to what you said earlier, that maybe there are some cooler heads out there. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a very high opinion of any politicians, particularly not the EU politicians, most of whom are not elected into their offices. But there was a four-way talks that took place within the last couple of days. As you know, there's been a ceasefire for the past several days, which is kind of a joke because the rebels keep fighting to secede and the Kiev forces keep shelling civilian apartment buildings and killing Russian journalists. So both sides are still shooting. But anyway, there was a four-way talks between the Ukrainian president, Russian president, French and German leaders. And it's pretty interesting if you think about it. These talks are excluding the United States. So I would say probably it gives it probably a better chance of being successful because the U.S. from the very beginning seems to be the party that's been ginning this whole thing up. And I think the Europeans, as ridiculous as they are and as lapdogish as they are toward the U.S., they do recognize, particularly Germany's business sector, they recognize they've got a lot to lose here if things go south. So perhaps if they can keep the U.S.'s nose out of it, they might find some sort of a way to extend the ceasefire and to look for some sort of political solution to this problem.
Yeah, it seems like the Russians, you know, again, I'm just speculating here, but it seems like the Russians must have told the Kiev junta that, hey, look, you know the Americans are going to focus on backing you up and all of this mess for more than a little while. They're already off chasing kidnapped girls in Nigeria and bogged down again in Iraq and whatever. You don't take them seriously like they're going to support you over the long term. Let's just come to the table and end this thing now before it gets worse. I mean, why wouldn't they say that? And why wouldn't that be the perfect advice? I mean, it seems like, I don't know exactly what they said, but that's certainly what I would have said, and that certainly would ring true to anybody in Kiev, too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They'll take the support where they can get it when they can get it, but count on Uncle Sam? Come on.
Do you remember, Scott, it was just a couple of weeks ago when all of the usual voices were screaming that Russia was poised to invade the Baltics. Poised to invade Poland. You had the lunatics, the Secretary General of NATO, Rasmussen, who was going on about, Russia is ready to invade and Putin is ready to invade. And now what's interesting is almost the opposite has happened. Putin has almost lost credibility with those who wanted a more aggressive protection of Russian speakers and ethnic Russians across the border by asking to have the authorization for force rescinded, by explicitly disassociating himself with the groups that are fighting. And you see the groups in eastern Ukraine now who really don't have a sponsor, who don't have anyone backing them. And I think you're seeing a lot of frustration. So it's ironic that the opposite of what the usual voices here were claiming has seemed to have taken place.
Yeah, and, you know, as far as him undermining his credibility with the people in the East, you could see how it makes perfect international politics that, you know, you might even, the anti-Putinists might even want to speculate that he deliberately set these Western idiots up to make a bunch of, you know, crazy predictions about what he was going to do. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just so he could not do it and make them all look like fools, like he's done.
As those of us were saying all along, even though we were accused of all sorts of stupid things, Putin is a politician. You know,
right.
he's not Hitler. He's not a savior. He's a politician.
And he isn't the one who started this either.
No, it was Victoria Nuland, and it was President Obama, and it was President Bush before him who bankrolled the first Orange Revolution. And now you have the second one that seems to have been successful for now. Probably doesn't have a long shelf life either, actually.
Yeah. Well, and they lost Crimea, which was the only point in the first place, was they wanted it, right? So what's the point of taking Ukraine if you don't get to keep the Crimea?
I know. It's the best beach, isn't it?
Well, I guess the Port of Odessa is something, too, but anyway. Man, I just forgot the other thing I was going to say, which was going to be great, but that happens from time to time on the show. So now, what about military equipment? The Americans are sending still what kind of aid and in what kind of quantities? Do you know?
Well, they are sending. What's interesting, and I saw someone else. This is not an original thought of mine, but someone else pointed this out. You know, in Iraq, the so-called advisors that are being sent in from Maliki are special forces. So you know what kind of advisors they are. So this person, I think it was Twitter or somewhere, wondered, what about these so-called American advisors in Ukraine? What kinds of people are these? It's probably safe to speculate they're also special forces, and they're also trying to get this pretty wrecked Ukrainian military into shape to fight a guerrilla warfare against the people in the East. And yet when you have a couple of crappy T-64 tanks rolling down the road, the usual suspects here were screaming about a Russian invasion yet again.
Right. Well, and, you know, yeah, it was when Brennan came to town was when they announced their first big anti-terrorism operation in the East there. So I think it was even in the New York Times they kind of noted that, I wonder if these things have anything to do with each other. Speaking of the New York Times, that was the other thing I was going to say was I thought you'd get a laugh out of this if you hadn't already seen it. Was Robert Perry's piece about the New York Times said, oh, well, you know, the reason that Putin has renounced his authority to use force is because he's backing down before the all-powerful might of America and our threat of future sanctions.
Exactly. I mean, you just can't win. You just can't win with these people. You know, they just keep pushing it and keep pushing it.
He went from Hitler to Chamberlain in 1 minute.
Exactly.
He's appeasing us now.
Yeah. Well, look at the same people who were talking about Iraq for so long.
Yeah, the very same ones. In fact, yeah, for people who aren't familiar with the gossip, it's fun. Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, the co-author of Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy, Bill Kristol's alter ego, the architect of destruction.
Yes, and her brother-in-law is the architect of the surge.
Yep. All right, we're all out of time. Thank you so much. Dan McAdams, everybody's at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity.
Thanks, Scott.